This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every once in a rare while, we'll rip something out of the news because we have to. But we're going to keep playing it again and again because we only pick those things that are worth hearing about. Well, we always ask ourselves, would somebody want to hear about this next year and the year after? And this particular man, you heard a lot about him when he passed last week and this weekend. Many of you saw his funeral covered live on television on all the major news networks. And that generally warrants our coverage. And by the way, we did the same thing with Whitney Houston. We're going to do the same thing with whoever they've touched the world, we want to cover it. And Justice Scalia touched the world. One of the things we did is we had a correspondent up near where his funeral mass was held. And we have some clips from that, so I wanted to run a few by you. The first was Father Sean Tunick, a nearby priest.
My name's Father Sean Tunick. I'm a Catholic priest of the Archdiocese of Kansas City, Kansas, and here in Washington, D.C., studying canon law at Catholic University. So I've been familiar with Justice Scalia for a long time and admired what I saw as his work from the outside, but I... since coming to study law, we study a bit of civil law as well as the canon law, and started to read his opinions, and you read one and you're just like, wow, who is this justice, the way he writes, and immediately just it comes off, not just his wit, but he is so smart and intelligent, and he would point out things you could see right away that the other justices hadn't even thought of, and so I just wanted to read everything that he wrote, and so I appreciate very much his approach to the law. I think it preserves liberty for the greatest number of people. I especially appreciated, though, just him as a Catholic and a Catholic civil servant, that so many times we don't have very good examples of that. A lot of times our Catholic politicians sacrifice their faith and what is true and moral to get ahead, and Justice Scalia was very committed to his principles and what he believed in and his duty to God first, and that's why he did what he did and why he was such a great civil servant, because of he knew he was God's servant first. And after our great patron saint of lawyers, St. Thomas More, King's good servant, but God's first. And Justice Scalia was certainly that, and he made us all proud in both respects. And I especially enjoyed his... friendship with Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan. He really showed us that we can have strong intellectual debates, disagreements even, and then go home as friends. That it's not all about emotivism and whose feelings are hurt. It's about making intellectual arguments. And he was able to do that with the best of them and then be someone's best friend too, which is pretty amazing these days. So we're going to miss him greatly.
Beautiful words by Father Sean. And we will do a half hour on Sir Thomas More. Even though this is Our American Stories, so much of our heritage comes from England, and there are no better stories about faith, conscience, and in the end, sacrifice than Thomas More's, Sir Thomas More. Next, we heard from Kelly Fedoric, an attorney.
We've been standing out here for the past several hours, and it's been well worth the wait to honor such an incredible man, not only an incredible justice, someone who's brought so much wisdom to the law, to the legal profession, but also just a good father, a good grandfather. So here to honor that man's legacy.
Next, Terry Campo, a lawyer from Illinois who in college, well, he was one of the early advocates of the Federalist Society. And as we had discussed last week, and you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to capture the hour we did on Justice Scalia last week. The Federalist Society is something that Justice Scalia really got behind when he was a professor at the University of Chicago. Let's hear from Terry Campo.
I'm Terry Campo from Springfield, Illinois, but I knew Justice Scalia when he was a law professor in Chicago and was involved in helping form the Federalist Society with us. We were the first of the attorneys chapter of the Federalist Society.
And then, last but not least, let's hear from Mark Hemingway.
Whatever you want to say about, you know, Justice Scalia's legal acumen, and you could say quite a bit, he was an absolutely amazing writer. He really just, the clarity and precision of word use that he employed was just absolutely incredible. And the other thing is, actually, it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, my wife and I saw him speak up at Catholic University, and And I was blown away because I'd respect him from a distance from afar, but in person, he just had a tremendous presence and was an incredibly generous and, you know, lighthearted and you know, fun guy. Fun may be a bit strong, but, like, he was very, very welcoming and very, very gracious and very amusing.
Right.
He was not at all this, like, you know, evil, pugnacious guy that, you know, people often made him out to be.
No, he was nothing like that, and folks who disagreed with him ended up just vilifying him, and in the end, smearing him, and you're going to get none of that here at Our American Stories. We celebrate great men, and we celebrate them in the way they deserve to be celebrated, and what was most remarkable, again, about Scalia was what Father Sean Tunick talked about, those friendships he had with people he disagreed with. Justice Ginsburg, my goodness, there was an opera written, a humorous opera about the two of them, because they were both big opera fans. And Justice Scalia and Kagan, one of the younger members of the court. And again, someone who disagreed with them on many issues. But they were dear friends.
They went shooting together.
And they went shooting together, as Alex just pointed out. So they hunted. Justice Scalia taught Justice Kagan a thing or two about being out in the field with a firearm. And when we come back, we're going to hear from the Justice's son himself, Paul Scalia, Reverend Paul Scalia, who delivered the homily at the funeral mass for his father. And it was special, and we bring it to you because no one else will. Who was this man that everyone's now discussing? Well, we spent about an hour last week, and his life deserves another. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. You'll be at the scene of the funeral mass when we return after these messages. And this is Our American Stories. You're listening to Coheed and Cambria singing his dissenting opinions. That's Justice Scalia's dissenting opinions in a riff, a rap. Justices had songs written after him, and it's witty and it's funny, and it honors a great man who brought wit to the court, did whatever he could do to get ordinary folks to understand what the real debates were all about. And we're going to get to some columns later. I think the two best, one by a liberal who worked with Justice Scalia because he insisted on hiring a liberal clerk, and not many justices would demand an opposing viewpoint in his room at that staff level, because clerks are just, well, they're freshies straight out of law school. And her post in the Washington Post was extraordinary. And then we'll hear from Newt Gingrich on the other side, and a friend of mine, Vince Haley, who co-wrote a column on Scalia about what his life was really all about, and they summed it up in two words: who decides? And Newt's always been great at that. Let's go to the funeral mass. And it started out with Leonard Leo, the executive VP of the Federalist Society, doing the first reading at this Mass.
A reading from the Book of Wisdom. The souls of the just are in the hand of God, and no torment shall touch them. They seemed, in the view of the foolish, to be dead, and their passing away was thought an affliction, and their going forth from us utter destruction. But they are in peace. For if before men, indeed they be punished, yet is their hope full of immortality. Chastised a little, they shall be greatly blessed, because God tried them and found them worthy of himself. As gold in the furnace, he proved them, and as sacrificial offerings, he took them to himself. In the time of their visitation, they shall shine and shall dart about as sparks through stubble. They shall judge nations and rule over peoples, and the Lord shall be their king forever. Those who trust in him shall understand truth, and the faithful shall abide with him in love, because grace and mercy are with his holy ones, and his care is with his elect. The word of the Lord.
Next up, Justice Clarence Thomas with the second reading.
A reading from the letter of St. Paul to the Romans. Hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. For Christ, while we were still helpless, yet died at the appointed time for the ungodly. Indeed, only with difficulty does one die for a just person, though perhaps for a good person one might even find courage to die. But God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. How much more then, since we are now justified by his blood, will we be saved through him from the wrath? Indeed, if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, how much more, once reconciled, will we be saved by his life? Not only that, but we also boast of God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. The word of the Lord.
And then it was on to Justice Scalia's son, Father Paul Scalia, who delivered the homily. And here he is on confession.
One time, one Saturday afternoon, he did scold me for having heard confessions that afternoon, that same day. And I hope that is some source of consolation, if there are any lawyers present, that the Roman collar was not a shield against his criticism. The issue that evening was not that I'd been hearing confessions, but that he had found himself in my confessional line. And he quickly departed it. As he put it later, like, heck if I'm confessing to you.
And here's the son talking about the father and the subject, faith and country.
God bless Dad, as is well known, with a love for his country. He knew well what a close-run thing the founding of our nation was. And he saw in that founding, as did the founders themselves, a blessing. A blessing quickly lost when faith is banned from the public square or when we refuse to bring it there. So he understood that there is no conflict between loving God and loving one's country, between one's faith and one's public service. Dad understood that the deeper he went in his Catholic faith, the better a citizen and public servant he became. God blessed him with the desire to be the country's good servant because he was God's first.
And then the son just got to talk about, for a minute, Dad.
We Scalias, however, give thanks for a particular blessing God bestowed. God blessed Dad with a love for his family. We have been thrilled to read and hear the many words of praise and admiration for him, for his intellect, his writings, his speeches, his influence, and so on. But more important to us and to him is that he was Dad. He was the father that God gave us for the great adventure of family life. Sure, he forgot our names at times or mixed them up. But there are 9 of us. He loved us and sought to show that love and sought to share the blessing of the faith he treasured. And he gave us one another to have each other for support. That's the greatest wealth parents can bestow. And right now, we are particularly grateful for it.
And you could hear the son choking up a bit. And it is the greatest gift parents can give. And by the way, Justice Scalia himself, as we learned last week, had that kind of love. He was an only child. And we learned in a 60 Minutes interview several years back that there weren't even cousins. And he said, yeah, you could call me a spoiled kid. But he said, but I was loved. I had people who had my back. And my goodness, so many of the world's problems wouldn't be problems if every child in this country could say those words rightfully. Don't you think? This is Lee Habib. More from Justice Scalia's funeral mass this weekend. A mass that if you didn't see it, you're blessed to hear it right now. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this past weekend, a great man was buried, and we're honoring him. CNN, NBC, MSNBC, Fox News, C-SPAN, everybody covered his funeral, and there was a reason. And we were in the middle of listening to Justice Scalia's son, Paul, the Reverend Paul Scalia, the priest in the family. As he said, look, I had 5 boys. One of them better be a priest. I'm a Catholic and I'm Italian. And one was, and it was Paul. As he said, Paul took one for the team. And he laughed. Because that's who Scalia was. He was fun. And so his son had just gotten finished discussing what kind of a father his father was. And my goodness, don't we all want to hear those kinds of words spoken about us at our funeral, those of us who are fathers? It's all that matters, folks. Well, here was the son talking to the throngs of people at this beautiful cathedral in Washington, D.C., on why they were at the funeral in the first place.
He was a practicing Catholic, practicing in the sense that he hadn't perfected it yet. Or rather, Christ was not yet perfected in him. And only those in whom Christ is brought to perfection can enter heaven. We are here then to lend our prayers to that perfecting, to that final work of God's grace in freeing Dad from every encumbrance of sin. But don't take my word for it. Dad himself, not surprisingly, had something to say on the matter. Writing years ago to a Presbyterian minister whose funeral service he admired, he summarized quite nicely the pitfalls of funerals and why he didn't like eulogies. He wrote, "Even when the deceased was an admirable person, indeed, especially when the deceased was an admirable person, praise for his virtues can cause us to forget that we are praying for and giving thanks for God's inexplicable mercy to a sinner." Now, he would not have exempted himself from that. We are here then, as he would want, to pray for God's inexplicable mercy to a sinner, to this sinner, Antonin Scalia. Let us not show him a false love and allow our admiration to deprive him of our prayers. We continue to show affection for him and do good for him by praying for him, that all stain of sin be washed away, that all wounds be healed, that he be purified of all that is not Christ. That he rest in peace.
And then the son, and this is the final clip that we have, and it's available on the web, the full thing, if you're interested. And you can catch this on ouramericannetwork.org. And it is Justice Scalia's son reflecting on our lives, all of us.
Even as we pray for Dad to enter swiftly into eternal glory, we should be mindful of ourselves. Every funeral reminds us of just how thin the veil is between this world and the next, between time and eternity, between the opportunity for conversion and the moment of judgment. So we cannot depart here unchanged. It makes no sense to celebrate God's goodness and mercy to Dad if we are not attentive and responsive to those realities in our own lives. We must allow this encounter with eternity to change us, to turn us from sin and towards the Lord.
And what beautiful words. And so much has been written since, and we wanted to cover just a few of the really wonderful things written about Justice Scalia. And one was by Tara Cole in the Washington Post. And she worked for Justice Scalia. She clerked for him. And by the way, if you don't know it, getting a clerkship for the Supreme Court out of law school is the most coveted, and I know thou shalt not covet, but it's one of the most treasured prizes for a young lawyer. And you don't practice law in a big firm. You go and you work for not the greatest wages, but the honor of working in that court for a Supreme Court judge is, well, there's nothing higher. And she wrote this, and here is the headline. "I'm a liberal lawyer. Clerking for Scalia taught me how to think about the law." That was the headline. And here's what she wrote. "I wanted the job because I was eager to learn how someone so brilliant could see the world so differently than I did. When I was in law school, a Supreme Court clerkship was the Holy Grail. For me, it was clerking for Justice Antonin Scalia. Now that I'm a partner at a law firm that serves the notoriously progressive entertainment industry, the fact that I once clerked for Scalia often elicits looks of surprise from those sitting across from me who ask if I'm the functional equivalent of a unicorn, a conservative in Los Angeles, a place that Scalia had amusingly warned me would, quote, melt my brain. I tell them no, I'm politically liberal, but that my time working for the justice was one of the defining experiences of my life. I'd heard all through law school that Scalia always hired one liberal clerk, though my sense is that this practice had waned in recent years. In fact, the process of applying for a Supreme Court clerkship entails applying to all nine justices, the notion being that justices choose clerks and not the other way around. But Justice Scalia was the person for whom I most wanted to work, not because we were ideologically aligned, but because we were not. It had to do with the way he was so deeply vilified, both personally and as a jurist, by so many of my classmates. He was discussed in almost cartoonish fashion, conjuring images of twirled mustaches and barely concealed devil horns. It was a time just after Bush v. Gore and 9/11 when battle lines had been drawn, and it was politically correct to reject wholesale any belief that was not your own. That approach made me uncomfortable, and I found myself becoming more and more interested in Scalia's work, eager to understand how someone so clearly brilliant could see the world so differently than I did. It's why I took the job. And in some ways, the job is a strange one. To assist in the writing of opinions, clerks have to get inside a justice's mind, to think as they do, and to write as they would. My role was to facilitate his, and sometimes that was easier than others. In one case, I worked on writing a dissent, the position held by a majority of the court, with which I fundamentally disagreed on a moral level, but found, as I wrote, that I was drawn to Scalia's reasoning, his emphasis on precedent, strict textual construction, and judicial restraint. While I remain bound not to discuss details of that case I worked on, I can say that Scalia's arguments in that case conveyed a clarity not found in the majorities, which relied on legal and verbal gymnastics in order to reach the desired outcome. His approach had logic and simplicity that resonated with me despite my politics. I found myself able to get inside his mind in that moment to sublimate my own views and write confidently in his voice. I was proud when my co-clerk told me that Scalia had called it a knockout. And when we come back, you're going to hear the rest of this beautiful essay by this remarkable woman. Because what a thing to do, to go clerk for the judge who you didn't understand, and maybe understand herself better. And what a judge to want and to look for and seek a young person with whom to disagree and learn from on the bench. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More from Tara Coles, column in the Washington Post. Clerking for Scalia taught me how to think about the law. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we left off with Tara Coles' column in the Washington Post, and the headline was, I'm a liberal lawyer, clerking for Scalia, taught me how to think about the law. I wanted to pick up where we left, then we'll hear a little something from Newt Gingrich on the other side of the political aisle, and then a clip from Jeffrey Tucker with a story, a personal story about Justice Scalia, to close out this hour celebrating the man and his life. Everybody's been discussing his life, but not who he was. They've been discussing his life in the pretext and the pretense of who's next, who's the next judge, what's happening next. Very little talk about the man, and that's why we've spent a total of 2 hours on his life. And by the way, we spent 2 hours on Jackie Robinson's life and Walt Disney's life and all kinds of Americans who are about to spend a good deal of time on Levi Strauss's life. important men and women in our country's history. Hedy Lamarr. Go to our website, ouramericannetwork.org, and take a listen. Well, here's where this young lady led off. There were other days, though, when I found myself sitting on Scalia's worn leather couch, looking up at Leroy, the mounted elk's head that dominated the justice chambers. Yeah, it had a name, Leroy. Wondering how both Leroy and I had gotten there, as Scalia and my three conservative co-clerks all found common ground that I simply could not access. I would think to myself, you really think that? That can't be right. Were refrains I often heard in response to bench memos I prepared in advance of oral argument. I'll admit that I went back and forth between playing the part of contrarian and simply trying to give the justice the recommendations he was looking for. There were times I was pleased when he noted my penchant for disagreement. Once, when my co-clerk gave him a draft of an important opinion, Scalia nodded toward me, smiled, and said, "Let's give it to Mikey," quoting the old Life cereal commercial. "She doesn't like anything." In these moments, I felt I had license to challenge Justice Scalia, and my arguments were always met with energetic debate and his eagerness to prove me wrong. At other times, I simply wanted his approval and for him to tell me that I was finally thinking, quote, right, which he meant with its full double entendre. I missed the mark a few times when I made assumptions about what Justice Scalia would think based on his political leanings. In one particular criminal case, I tried to anticipate his reaction and gave him the analysis I thought he wanted. But when I suggested he might want to follow the more conventionally conservative line of thinking, he looked at me incredulously and said, "We can't do that." There was another case where we were tasked with writing the majority opinion when I saw him struggle and ultimately change his mind after realizing that the text of the statute would not support the position he initially wanted to take. That was the one time the justice, who was very respectful of personal time and valued his own, called me on a weekend and asked me to come into the chambers. As we worked through the case together, the power went out in our wing of the court. Rather than taking a break, we moved our chairs and books into the hallway using the natural light that came through the courtyard. This prompted Justice David Souter, who was famously averse to using modern technology, including seemingly the light bulb, to poke fun at our inability to read in dim light. If there was a true surprise during my year clerking for Scalia, it was how little reference he made to political outcomes. What he cared about was the law and where the words on the page took him. More than any one opinion, this will be his lasting contribution to legal thought. Whatever our beliefs, he forced lawyers and scholars to engage on his terms, textual analysis and original meaning. He forced us all to acknowledge that words cannot mean anything we want them to mean, that we have to impose a degree of discipline on our thinking, a discipline I value to this day. Justice Scalia treated me with enormous respect and always seemed to value my opinion, a heady experience for someone just a year out of law school. I never felt as though he looked at me differently than my conservative counterparts. His trust felt implicit, which is, perhaps, why I struggled so much between wanting to challenge him and wanting to please him. He was also, hands down, the smartest person I've ever known. What would take me weeks to understand would take him minutes to process. I'll never forget my first experience handing him an opinion and watching him in a matter of minutes type a few lines into his typewriter. Yes, a typewriter, even in 2004. And instantly cut to the heart of the issue in a way that I'd simply been unable to do. When I read his new draft, I realized that I'd tried too hard to bridge the difference between his opinion and that of another justice in order to hold our majority. His changes strengthened the argument, but also, I feared, risked putting us in the dissent. But Justice Scalia didn't compromise his principles, even on the smallest of issues. He knew his mind, and he taught me the importance of knowing my own. My goodness, what a legacy for a justice to have that kind of a note written on his behalf by someone probably in their mid-20s, and he on the highest court in the land wanting to hear her opinions. and wanting to argue with her, respecting her enough, by the way, to have an argument. And I think that's what Scalia believed deeply. We need to argue more and not less, but better. We need to argue better and fairer and more honestly and not attack each other when we argue. And then there was the column by Newt Gingrich and Vince Haley in the Washington Times, The Wisdom of Antonin Scalia, and here's how it started. Quote, "I hope to impart to you the courage to have your wisdom regarded as stupidity." For decades, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia shared some form of this message with countless audiences. One might think that these words of encouragement were meant for the ears of young Federalist Society lawyers engaged in the ongoing battle to defend the Constitution. But in fact, Justice Scalia directed those words not to fellow lawyers, but at fellow Christians. Said Scalia at one such gathering, "Surely those of you who adhere to all or most traditional Christian beliefs are regarded in educational circles that you and I travel as, well, simple-minded." As an example, he noted a recent story in the Washington Post that called Christian fundamentalists, quote, "poorly educated and easily led," unquote. Scalia urged that, rather than retreat, Christians confront such contempt head-on and be willing, in the words of St. Paul, to be seen as, quote, "fools for their belief in God." And so imagine that this man touched, well, just about everyone he came in contact with, on the left and the right. And there's one particular story off of the Foundation for Economic Education's website by Jeffrey Tucker. And Jeffrey also works with and for the Acton Institute and the Heartland Institute. And this is a personal story that I think was the most powerful of everything that had been written about Justice Scalia. And we got Jeffrey to record this for us.
It was a spring afternoon some years ago, and he was attending church services, sitting in the back pew, holding his prayer book in his hands. The mass had ended and most people had gone, and he was still saying prayers alone in the back pew. He finally got up and began to walk out, and there were no reporters, nobody watching. There was only a woman who had been attending the same services, and she had no idea who he was. And I was a bystander. He didn't know I was there. What was a bit unusual about this woman, she had lashing sores on her face and hands, and they were open sores. There was some disease, and not just physically. She behaved strangely, a troubled person you might meet in large cities and quickly walk away from. A person to avoid, and certainly never touch. For whatever reason, she walked up to Justice Scalia, who was alone. He took her hands, though they were full of sores, and she leaned in to say something, and she began to cry. He held her face next to his, and she talked beneath her tears that were now streaming down his suit, and he didn't flinch. He didn't even try to get away. He just held her while she spoke, and this lasted for perhaps for more than 5 minutes. He closed his eyes while she spoke, gripping her back with his hand and cradling her face in his other hand. He didn't recoil. He stood there with conviction and love. There were no cameras and no other onlookers besides myself, and he had no idea I was there. And finally she finished. And what he said comforted her. She gained composure and she pulled away, ready to go. And he held her rough, sore-filled hands and had a few final words that I could not hear, and he gave her some money. Then she walked away. He stood there for a moment, and then he walked away across the green grass towards the Supreme Court building alone. He was probably preparing for an afternoon of work, and I just stood there in awe. I mean, here we have one of Washington's most powerful men, a star by any standard. Cameras followed him all over. That kind of attention can get to you in time. You might begin to believe that your life is a performance. But not in Justice Scalia's case. What I saw that day was a humble man, a compassionate man, a man who believed in the power of personal contact.
Justice Scalia had lots of personal contacts. He changed the world with his spirit his words, his intellect, his wit, his love of life, his love of his fellow man. But the image that will burn in my memory is of Scalia holding that woman in the church pew, consoling her, making her feel loved, just as his parents loved him, and his God loved him too. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. Check out hillsdale.edu to learn more about going there, sending your kids there, or heck, taking some of their terrific online courses. You don't have to go to Hillsdale. Hillsdale can come to you. And today we're celebrating the life of a famed cartoonist, Chuck Jones. When I hear that music, I think of him immediately, and I just start smiling. Because to this day, these are still my little girl's favorites, and they were mine. And as she always tells me, Dad, the new stuff ain't as good. And I always say, it's isn't, not ain't. And Chuck Jones was born on this day in history. And to give you an idea of who Chuck Jones is and who some of his fans are, well, let's start with this clip from Robin Williams.
I'm here tonight, ladies and gentlemen, because I have a problem. I am addicted to cartoons. I've been to Animators Anonymous. I've checked into the Betty Boop wing of Betty Ford. I went to my therapist, knocked on the door, opened the door and said, "What's up, Doc?" And I realized it. I have a Jones for the work of Chuck Jones. Yes. Oh, you know. Oh, you know it's true. He is one of the true pioneers of animation, part of the team that gave us Looney Tunes. He worked on Bugs, Daffy, Porky, Elmer, the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote, Pepe Le Pew. It sounds like the guest list at Snoop Doggy Dog. I know.
Well, who was this man? It turns out Chuck's father was physically abusive. A father, though, that Chuck and his brother Kent still believed served his purpose in their lives. And their mother, she was an artist. Let's hear from Chuck Jones himself.
The reason I got into drawing was because I had the right parents. My mother felt that children could do no wrong. She would never criticize a child's drawing, and that was probably the most important thing of all.
And then we had a father who was always going into new businesses, and he was always failing in them, and he always ended up with a whole bunch of letterheads that nobody could ever use except us to draw on the back of.
But he said, you never know when you're going to get a drawing worth keeping.
Well, the father, of course, gave the reason that all this stuff was laying and the paper could be played with, but the real reason the dad wanted that paper out the door is he didn't want to be reminded of all those failed businesses, so he wanted the kids to just draw on it and then toss it. Let's hear more about Chuck Jones.
I started reading when I was about three, I think, a little over three. My father felt that it was best if we did our own reading. He said he had too many things he wanted to read himself to waste his time reading to us. He said, we want to read, learn to read. He said, hell, you learn to walk in 2 years, you can certainly learn to read in three. And so we all did. We all learned to read very early. And he helped us by saying to it that we had plenty of things to read. And he would, in those days, people moved a lot, and very often people left their whole libraries. Now, you must understand, and anybody reading, living today, in the day of television and even radio and stuff, that in those days there wasn't any such thing. And there was reading was what you did. That's how you found out things.
And again, that was Chuck, and he was speaking to the Academy of Achievement. And imagine what he said. Let's just hit that again. He said, "Oh, we all learned to read very early, and Dad helped us by seeing to it that we had plenty of things to read. You must understand, anybody living today, or the day of television or radio and stuff, in those days there wasn't any such thing. Reading was what you did. That's how you found out things. Boy, I think we all sometimes miss those days." Reading was so important to his dad that they moved constantly so that they could take in the libraries of many homes. Here again is Chuck and Kent.
We did move around a lot, and the way we moved was that my father would look around until he'd read at the house that had books in it.
Not just books, but good books. Full sets of Mark Twain, full sets of Dickens, Baudelaire, O. Henry, de Maupassant. And we had read every single one of those, all of us, and we ended up with a pretty good knowledge of world literature.
With all this learning on his own, Chuck felt like he didn't need school.
8 and 8 is 16.
I hated school.
16 and 16 is 32.
I was miles ahead, as it turned out, of most kids of my age. And these people were wallowing around in these platitudes.
4 and 4 is 8.
Well, although Chuck's feelings were justified, they weren't looked upon very highly in a school he didn't care about. So Chuck's dad once again served his purpose and put his son into art school, the place where he belonged, but the place we parents are often too afraid to go, let alone send our kids. That our sons and daughters, well, they might be seen different from so-called normal students and might be better there. Here's Chuck on this critical inflection point in his life.
I was summarily thrown out of high school. He put me in art school, and I figured because I was in an art school that I necessarily was an artist. And until this wonderful old man got up, his name was a wonderful name. He's a great art teacher. His name was Francois Murphy. Which is kind of like on a roller coaster. You know, you go up on the Francois and then drop off into the Murphy. He was a wonderful old gent, and then he got up there and he said to all of us, we're ready to go, you know, to draw. And he said, every one of you birds has 100,000 bad drawings in you. The sooner you get rid of them, the better it'll be for everybody. And a lot of the fellows decided that they, you know, they didn't want to go through that kind of nonsense. But I was already on my second 100,000, so I decided to stick around.
Wow, what great advice. Every one of you birds has 100,000 bad drawings in you, and the sooner you can get rid of them, the better for everybody. Great advice for young writers, artists. The life of Chuck Jones. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
From your pillow to the shadow of a willow tree, and tiptoe dans les tulips avec moi. Bonjour, Monsieur Frog. Comment allez-vous this fine morning? Knee deep in flowers will stray.
The frog just smelled peppy.
And this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Story, celebrating the life of Chuck Jones and one of his great creations, Pepe Le Pew. Let's hear some more.
Don't let two lips avec. Hey! A lady, feminine, female, girl, skunk. In the spring, a young man's love lightly turns to thoughts of fancy.
Never get away with this today. Up,
no, you couldn't.
Hello,
because it wasn't
lover.
Just seduction. I mean, this was outright harassment.
Yeah.
And we're celebrating the life of Chuck Jones. And coming out of art school, Chuck's very first dream, we find out, and we're hearing from Chuck Jones himself, was shattered.
What I hope for, of course, is what every art student hopes for, and if he doesn't dream this way, when he's in art school, he shouldn't be in art school. And that was that you hope that you would, when you finish school, go to Paris and get yourself a colorful little attic looking out over the rooftops of Paris, and there you would paint with beautiful girls as your models and die at a picturesque old age of, say, 37, dying of consumption and sort of a male Camille, you know. Well, unfortunately, when I got out of school, I found out it cost money to die poor. You had to get there, right? Well, I couldn't get there.
Chuck was coming out of art school right in 1931, in the worst of the Great Depression. Chuck said, quote, "To expect to get a job when 3 out of every 10 people were unemployed was ridiculous, particularly for a kid without any experience in anything. I had worked my way through art school by being a janitor, but I never worked full-time as a janitor, and I wasn't sure I was capable. I was certainly willing. And to the willing came the treasure. Someone offered to pay him to do his, well, to do his thing and draw." He told the Academy of Achievement that he couldn't believe it.
I'm still astonished that somebody would offer me a job and pay me to do what I wanted to do. And to this day, that's been the astonishment of my life and delight of my life and the wonder of my life and the puzzlement that anybody would be so stupid as to willing to do that.
Talk about humility. Jones, humble and focused. So focused that years later, when he was offered an opportunity to be the boss, a studio bigwig, he said no. He told the Academy of Achievement that he wasn't going to trade his tools, his passion, for a big desk and more money.
And I hear all these success stories of people, you know, these captains of industry and so on, these forgers of the world and empire builders and so on. And they talk about, you know, all the money they've made and, you know, become presidents and all that. And I thought, geez, but look at me. I never, when I was offered a chance to be head of studios, I wouldn't take it. I like to work with the tools of my trade, and the tools of my trade is a lot of paper and a pencil, and that's all it is.
A lot of paper and a pencil. That's all it is. And luckily for Chuck, he had the kind of parents who just let him be. Let him do it. You'd say that right now to a parent, I want to draw. Oh, good luck with that. Good luck with that. And let's hear a little bit more. Let's hear Elmer, Daffy, and Bugs.
Now it's duck hunting season. That, sir, is an investigated fabrication. It's wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. I say it's duck season, and I say fire. Let's try that again. Okay. I'll start it this time. Right. Wabbit season. Duck season. Wabbit season. Wabbit season. Duck season. Fire.
And we know
Bill goes backwards.
As Bill goes backwards, and we know. We don't even have to see it. We've seen it 100 times, and it doesn't matter how many times you watch it or hear it, you still laugh.
It's still funny.
It's still funny. And let's hear a little bit from another great character from Chuck Jones, Sylvester.
What are you going to do, pretty cat?
What am I going to do? How naive can you get? I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll play sandwich.
Ooh, Tootie, how do you play it?
Now, first, you step on this slice of bread. Then, I cover you with the other slice, like this.
What do I do now, Pooty? What do I do now?
No peeking.
What did you say, Pooty? What did you say? I can't hear you. Ooh, I don't like that game.
And Mel Blanc, what a talent, too. We can't leave him out of this equation. You just can't. You know, Jones, some great writing was done about Chuck Jones in the Wall Street Journal. There was a celebration of his life with an exhibit of his art. and it was called The Man Behind the Looney Tunes, How Bugs and Daffy Came to Life. And the writer was Will Friedwald. And he was writing about the Duck Amuck classic that launched his career, this man's life. And the thing they said that made it so distinctive was the believability of these characters. They reminded you of people in your life in the end. Every aspect of this film, Friedwald wrote, every aspect reminds us that Daffy is just a drawing, and yet over the past 60 years, Daffy has become no less real to us than Clark Gable or Humphrey Bogart. With a less believable star, the conceit of character versus animated could have been a big snooze. Instead, with this, quote, despicable fall guy of a leading man placed in the accomplished hands of Jones and company, Duck Amuck became a masterpiece of American film comedy. Jones was, in fact, easily one of the greatest comedy directors in the history of motion pictures, indisputably on par with Preston Sturges, Billy Wilder, Mel Brooks, or Woody Allen, and this is so true. Even though Jones would never be as famous as the characters he directed or helped create, Bugs, Porky, Elmer, the Roadrunner, Coyote, Pepe Le Pew, he came closer than any other animated filmmaker after Walt Disney to attaining the name above the title status of a Frank Capra, Alfred Hitchcock, or Martin Scorsese. And this column goes on. In a sense, Jones is even more distinctive a stylist than any Hollywood feature director. You can quickly identify his work from just a single frame, the same way you can immediately distinguish between the comic strips by George Harriman and Al Capp. Jones' earliest directorial efforts, particularly those starring the talkative, rather phlegmatic mouse named Sniffles, show an ability to create a naturalistic, believable character, but little else. Jones turned out classic with astonishing regularity, making the now-established Looney Tunes formulas work better than anyone else could by continually turning them on their head. And we think of, wow, my goodness, What's Up, Doc? One Froggy Evening. When Elmer finally kills the Wabbit in that epic, epic setting and scene, he is overcome with remorse and begins toting the lifeless carcass to Valhalla in the climax of Wabbiterdummerung, or Wabbiterdummerung. Always playing with titles, always playing with words. Yet Jones went on to do some of his best work in the years that followed, including two best adaptions of the Dr. Seuss stories, How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Horton Hears a Who. He lived to be an elder statesman with a broad range of stylistic descendants, not only in animation, but live-action films, television, theater, and even music. Jones's work was all about the tiniest of nuances. It isn't just that Wile E. Coyote falls off a cliff in his acme-aided efforts to catch the Roadrunner. It's the tiny, almost unnoticeable puff of smoke that appears at the bottom of the canyon that seals the deal. What we learn about this as well is that parts of Jones's own life are reflected in these characters. We learn this about Charles Schulz, too. Much of Charles's life was reflected in the character of Charlie himself in the Charlie Brown's Christmas, always feeling like the outsider and awkward. And we learn about that with Chuck Jones, too. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. The life of Chuck Jones, an artist, a cartoonist, a great director. The guy who makes my little girl cry, so he's my hero. This is Our American Stories. More after this.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we talk about everything here. Art, culture, health, education, and sometimes absolutely nothing. And this is one of those times.
Thanks.
You bet. Well, we're not trying to slam you, but, you know, your worries are not necessarily all ours. Hey, look, what made Seinfeld great? I mean, it was a show about nothing, and it was just the things that just bugged, really, what bugged George.
Nothing is cool.
Nothing is cool. So we're going in now for our periodic rants with Hengler, because so many things about this modern world just, I don't know how he copes, frankly. I really don't. But, you know, if he was around, I think, in the 19th century, he would have found things about that modern living that would have really gotten on his nerves. And so we turn it over to, well, Hengler's rant. What do you got? What's bugging you now, Greg?
I got a list of cliches that people use and words that people misuse. And so no particular order. This one really bugs me. I have four girls. And it just drives me crazy when I hear guys, especially dads, do the old, yeah, you know, you can stay away from my daughter. And they all pat each other in the back. Yeah, my daughter's going to get married to the 30.
I'm going to clean my shotgun.
Yeah, oh yeah, I'm going to stand at the door. And then especially these jerks that wear the shirt, the 10 reasons you got to do before you date my daughter.
I got one of those shirts.
It's so ridiculous.
I'm teasing.
Okay. But yeah, I mean.
Then there's the whiskey test, right? If they take the shot of whiskey, they're no good. And if they don't take the shot of whiskey, they're not trustable, because only a trustable guy would take a shot of whiskey, right?
All right, I haven't heard that. You know, have her back by 7. It's so ridiculous. Like, don't you want her to be looking for a quality guy instead of this whole cliche garbage? I just think it's laziness. And I think these guys need to really step it up and maybe spend some more time with their daughters. Let's move on. Stranger danger. It's so ridiculous. Oh, going back to the first one about dads and the daughters. You know, when I hear this, the first thing I think of, they're like, you know, girls, you know, just stay away from guys. You know, they're bad news.
They're no good.
They're no good. You know what? I want my daughter to love these guys. I want them to you know, watch out for them. I have pictures of my daughter on the playground walking up to boys who are sitting there by themselves and, you know, trying to comfort them and love on them. That's what the message I want to be giving my daughters. None of this nonsense that are cliches, which ties into the whole stranger danger thing. That same thing. I tell my daughter, you know, we don't necessarily trust the strangers, but we are to love on them. So when you see them, you smile at them. You say hi. You ask them how their day is going. You make sure you give them eye contact. But this whole cliche about strangers to just stay away from, it's just ridiculous. It goes against everything that I'm teaching my daughters. This one, you know, when somebody breaks up with somebody, you can do better. Oh, come on. It's so just ridiculous. I'm just going to leave it at that. This one. This one, when I was young and playing youth.
By the way, just back to you could do better.
Yeah.
First of all, it's an insult to the person you just said it to, because what if they love that person?
Right.
I mean, what a nasty thing to say. Say, I'm sorry. Say, you know, you'll get through it.
There's more fish in the sea.
There's more fish in the sea.
There was a girl who once broke up with me, and I said, good luck finding someone better.
Oh.
That's a cliche.
So, I've never heard that before. I thought that was unique.
No. So this one, when I was playing youth sports, it drove me absolutely insane. And it was mostly during baseball, because that's when you can really hear the parents in the stands. And it was when somebody would get K'd, and it was always, you know, the kid playing right field. And you would hear the parents say, nice try, like, what are they supposed to do? A lot of the times they'd have their bat on the shoulder with cobwebs. They haven't even swung at the ball. And then somebody in the stands has to say, nice try. You didn't even try. It's, you know, at least swing the bat. But there is, you don't get credit for trying. I think that was the kind of the little peek into the participation trophy, which didn't happen in my generation, but it was like kind of the setup to the participation trophy was the words, nice try. Anyway.
Good game.
Yeah, well, that's fine. But here comes, here, Here comes a trifecta. And this is the modern day thing, and this irks me so much. And it's, let's start it out with number one. It's all good. It ain't all good. First of all, the people that are saying it's all good, usually it's something really bad that happened. Then they'll just throw it out. It's all good. What do you mean it's all good? What are you talking about?
No
worries.
There's
a lot of garbage out there.
No, no worries.
Yeah, no worries. That one was the adaptation of Australian. People trying
no worries,
to sound.
Mate.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
By the way, I like saying it is what it is. That infuriates people too.
That one's fine with me. All right. No. Number two.
The almighty judge here.
Keeping it real. Whenever somebody says they're keeping it real, you always know they're going to do something really stupid. Nobody ever like goes, hey, watch me. You know, I'm going to walk up and give this person a dollar who's sitting outside the store and is homeless. I'm going to keep it real. No! They always say they're going to keep it real when they're about ready. Watch this. You know, that guy just talked back to me. I'm going to punch him in the face. I'm going to keep it real.
Yeah, I'm going to rob a liquor store.
Yeah.
Keeping it real.
Keeping it real stupid is what they're doing. And then, this is the third one. Stop being a hater. I mean, it's just stop.
Don't drink your hatering.
Yeah, your hater. So dumb. And again, whatever the person is doing is probably dumb.
What happened to don't hate the player, hate the game?
Oh.
Too old, huh?
This one is my number one pet peeve. And actually, Alex used it on me, and it just set me off. He sent me an email, and he used these words, and I threw back a nasty email because it just got so much under my skin.
Several emails. It wasn't just one.
No, but this one is just, oh my, oh, this one is awful, and it is, hey, you know, who are we to judge, or stop judging. Oh, what do you mean stop judging? We're doing it every millisecond of our lives. If you've read the book Freakonomics, we just can't stop. It is innate in us. I'm constantly judging. What page should I go to? What am I supposed to do? What does this person look like? Everything that I'm looking around, I'm constantly judging. The only time somebody says to stop judging is because you're making a judgment that they don't like. That's it. It's not that they don't want you to judge. It means that they disagree with you and they throw out, you shouldn't judge. It needs to stop. I'm going to judge. You're judging me right now because of what I'm saying. You're making a judgment on me. You stop judging. If you're truly going to stay true to your cause, don't tell me to stop judging because you're doing, in fact, the same thing you want me to stop doing. Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Definitely judging you right now.
That's a big one.
Yeah, the stop judging. And then to throw it. And then I'm not even going to talk about, but to put it, to crouch it in biblical, framing in a biblical language, that will just send me off worse than I just was. So just, all right.
Just turn the other cheek.
That's fine. That's fine.
It's the same thing, I thought.
That's fine. Because I think that's fine. Anyways, here's the next one. I couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Listen to me. Listen to me clearly. Because so many people get this wrong. If you couldn't care less, you're not making at all a profound point. Because if there's room for you to care less, what are you trying to say? The whole point is that I couldn't care less. Did I get that right from the beginning?
No,
I could care less.
Do
it. Okay, so if you say I could care less, that you're not making a point because that means there's room for you to care lesser. Okay, I think 90% of the people get that wrong. Number two, peruse. Listen, people, peruse means to look over something in great detail. It doesn't mean to just flip quickly through the pages. Peruse means you look it over in detail. Everyone uses this one wrong. Peruse.
All right. I think somebody needs a Percocet.
Do I still have room?
Because it's
the end of the music.
We got 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah. Okay. To lay and to lie. All right. When you lay, it means you're setting something down. Lie is to yourself, the subject, lying in a horizontal position. All right?
We're going to lay this one, lie this one to rest. Right.
Why would
now.
I lie to myself?
This is Lee Habib. That is Hengler. Hengler needs, a sedative.
Don't judge
oxygen.
Me. Don't judge me.
Don't be a hater.
Yeah.
This is Lee Habib. This is our American story. We'll be right back.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our Faith in Action segment, where we tell stories about what people of faith do in the public square. But stories not told off enough in the public square. This week, it's a story we read in Philanthropy Roundtable's Philanthropy Magazine, a story that inspired us so much, we asked our field correspondent, Stan Dye, to chase it down.
Alan Barnhart is the CEO of Barnhart Crane and Rigging, a premier heavy lift and transport company based in Memphis, Tennessee, worth some $250 million, with more than 30 branches and 1,000 expert employees. If you want to move something big, say 19 million pounds of hardware at a nuclear power plant, Barnhart can do the job. But you may be surprised by some things that the Barnhart children have not been able to do, like take trips to Disney World, or buy toys that their family can presumably afford. As Alan says,
it has been a great benefit, I think frankly, to my children to not have to grow up as rich kids and to learn the word no and learn that they don't always get what they want. That was the theology from the Rolling Stones that I taught them. You don't always get what you want. You know that little song?
You can't always get what you want.
And that's not the only surprise.
We went to advisors and said, we'd like to give our business away. And they thought that that was imprudent. They thought that was not something that we should do.
Whoa, wait a minute. What madness is this? That almost sounds like the setup for a TV show where we say stranger and stranger things to people in suits and see how long they'll go along with it. But actually, Alan's seemingly odd request to give away his whole business is as sincere as it gets. This journey began some decades ago when Alan was in college.
My roommate and I, we'd always challenge each other, and we started talking about world hunger, and specifically about the famines that were going on in Ethiopia at that time. And we started wrestling with it, and how can this be, what can we do, and started asking ourselves a question of how can we live like we're living, the lifestyle that we have, when brothers and sisters in Christ are starving to death. And we wrestled with that for a few days and decided that we needed to do something. And we had planned to go skiing out in Colorado a few months later. And we decided to take the $350 that we were going to spend to go skiing and send it to World Relief, or World Vision, I think it was, to help the situation in Ethiopia. And we instead went to the local lake for spring break. It was probably the only sacrificial gift I've ever made in my life. And I know that my $350 didn't change much about Ethiopia, but it changed me. And it was a turning point in my life.
After graduation, Alan joined the family business and eventually took the reins along with his brother Eric, a responsibility he took seriously and in ways that you might not expect.
And so I decided that I would study through the Bible and read every verse I could read about business and about money and wealth, because that's the field that I was going into. And part of the whole purpose of business is to make money. So what does the Bible say about money? And I went through the whole Bible over about a two-year period, and I'm an engineer, so I'm kind of cataloging verses and trying to figure out what Scripture is saying. And I came away from that study with two primary takeaways. And the first one is that everything that I have and everything that I am has come from God and belongs to God, and I am a steward of it. And my job is to figure out what God wants me to do with the things that He's given me. None of it belongs to me. I have no rights. I'm a steward. The second one may surprise you a bit. The second one was, I came away with a fear of wealth, a fear of business success. If you start thinking about the Scriptures, how many Scriptures really would point to that fear? There were many of them. You know, Jesus said, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Why did He say that? He said, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth.
This was a fear so great that Alan, Eric, and their wives made plans to protect their families.
And so we made a decision on the front end before we had any money and before when business was just starting. And the decision was this. We're going to set for ourselves a financial finish line, a salary, a middle-class salary that we're going to make. And if God chooses to bless this business beyond what it takes to generate that salary, we're not going to see it as a call to increase our lifestyle, but instead we're going to see it as an opportunity to take that money and use it to fund ministry. And so that was the commitment that we made on the front end. The second thing that we did is we told other people about that commitment. We made the commitment before the Lord, but we also told others, including people within our company. And that locked in our decision. It gave us some real accountability.
Think about that for a moment. Many folks reflect on wealth, charity, and legacy towards the end of their careers. Here we have a family that set a financial finish line for themselves as they barely left the starting line before their business grew very much at all. But grow it did.
So now we were ready to start our business. We had set these guidelines in place or these safeguards in place, and we started our company. It was very small, again, just 10 guys in Memphis, and we didn't know if we would even survive the first year because it was a mom-and-pop business, and mom-and-pop were leaving. But the first year, we actually made some money, and we were so excited. We were able to, we had $50,000 extra money that we were able to give away. And one of the other things we said on the front end is if we did have any money to invest, we're going to do it as a group. And so it started out, there were six of us that got together and prayed and said, God, what do you want us to do with this money that you have generated? And we took it and we gave it away. And the next year, the company grew some more. And I think we had $150,000. And each year, the company just continued to grow. And it grew about 25% a year for the next 23 years. And for you math guys, that means it was 100 times bigger than it had been. And went from a very small company in Memphis to a company that works all over the U.S. and has about 1,000 employees. And our ability to give greatly ramped up. I mean, we got to the place in the early 2000s where we had $1 million a year to invest in the kingdom. And we had a much bigger group now trying to help us figure out how to do that and praying and saying, God, what do you want us to do? And in 2004, one of our guys said, we ought to set a goal. He's a salesman. You know how salesmen are. We ought to set a goal to be able to invest $1 million a month into the kingdom. And we thought, okay, whatever. But the next year, our industry just started booming. 2005 to 2008 were great years in our industry. And we went from a $50 million company to a $250 million company during that four-year period. And throughout that period and ever since, we've been able to invest over $1 million a month into the kingdom. And we're just amazed at what God is doing. We have no vision for this, no thought that this would ever happen. God has just chosen to pour out a huge amount of business success on our company.
The Barnharts immediately donated half of their profits to charity and reinvested the other half to grow the business. The $50,000 they gave to charity in that first year was more than Alan's entire salary. This voluntary income cap kept the Barnharts from ever earning more than their peers at Sunday school. But Alan will be the first to say that this is not some poverty lifestyle.
We have six children. The poverty level for a family of eight is $35,000. And that's about $4,400 per person, which would put you actually in the top 15% of people in the world. If you lived at the poverty level, that would put you in the top 15% of the world. And we live at about 3.5 times that level. So our salary is not a sacrificial salary. We make about $125,000 a year and have everything that we need.
Every bit as amazing as their engineering prowess or capitalist success story is their guiding moral vision, keeping them accountable from day one. A vision that's now a special sort of inheritance for their children. The Barnhart kids maybe didn't get new cars when they turned 16, but they certainly got something.
Our children have had the benefit of not having to grow up as rich kids, which is a difficult thing for kids to do. They've also had the benefit of seeing the world. We've traveled with them a lot, and we've also had benefit of people from in all types of ministries sitting at the dinner table talking about what they do. And so our kids' perspective has been broadened, and we believe in leaving our kids a rich inheritance, and we are trying to do that. We think that has very little to do with money. In fact, we think it would be almost counterproductive often, most often, to leave them money. But we'd want to leave them a very rich inheritance.
Reporting for Our American Stories, I'm Stan Dunn.
That's great work by Stan. And there's one other point I wanted to add here that we didn't cover in the story. The Barnharts, they keep operational control of this business, but they've given ownership of the business to the National Christian Foundation. And they did it to protect their hearts. And in the end, to keep that business going, and when profits are pushed out, they go to the kingdom. And that's the best of both worlds, my friends. The Christian heart at work and the entrepreneurial mind at work. And you'll hear this story only here on Our American Stories and stories like it. More after these messages.